Simon and Garfunkel's Scarborough Fair. Oh, that goes back some time. To before Chantal was even a twinkle in the
I wasn't
eye.
Even thought of.
Yeah, you missed the best part. Foreigner in front of that one, waiting for a girl like you. So there's lots, much more music on a Tuesday. And as I mentioned earlier, today we're going to be chatting with a very special guest, Brian Pottinger, who is a formidable writer, among other things. An interesting life, a very interesting life. Now, he's in the studio to talk about a book that he's written, and I just want to preempt it by reading the cover notes. It kind of sums up what the book is about, and it's beautifully written. It's called I Am Smiling. It's the personal and family autobiography of journalist and author Brian Pottinger, former editor and publisher of the Sunday Times. He was present at all the major moments of the peaceful revolution which brought democracy to South Africa. The author traces his family roots back to revolutionary France and Edwardian England to understand what brought his two grandfathers to these shores. He provides a highly personalized account of growing up in apartheid South Africa and of his sometimes hilarious, often brutal introduction to his journalistic calling. I Am Smiling is not merely a political memoir. It's the story of a many-faceted life. Student, soldier, taxi driver, railways, fireman and ticket inspector, journalist, editor, businessman, cafe owner, and chair of a family sugar farming enterprise. Brian, you've done it all. And an extraordinary life, now committed to print. In an extraordinary book called I Am Smiling, and I wondered about the title when I received it. And of course, it's revealed later on in the book that that is a direct quote from the former crocodile who you met in your career, no less, and worked with no less than five state presidents in this country. That's got to be a unique achievement in terms of journalism. But we'll get there. Let's take a couple of steps back. Your family came to South Africa. Why?
Dave, good afternoon. Thanks very much for the invitation. I think there was a push and a pull for both my grandparents. The pull, obviously, was here was this wonderful new country just emerging from the chaos of war, opportunity, riches, and they came for that. But there were push factors, different ones on both sides. On my maternal mother's side, the push there was a loss of family fortunes in the sugar farming industry in Mauritius. So that grandfather came up pretty much impoverished, Standard 3 certificate. A certificate as an electrician, and he came to work here, and he did well. The other side, my paternal side, my grandfather came out. It was a more romantic thing here. The allegation is that he had a sort of frowned-upon love affair, and he was either A, dispatched to South Africa to get away from it by his family, or he fled to South Africa to get away from his family, or he fled to South Africa to get away from his
amour.
Amour. But his amour, who was an extraordinarily strong-willed woman, hopped on a ship and came over here. They got married very happily and bore three sons.
So which of those versions do you personally believe was the truth?
I think it was a love match. Oh, yeah. I think he left because of the disapproval of his family. Oh. He came to South Africa on the promise of something great. And I think it was all arranged. And his amour climbed on the ship, which is quite a thing in those days, came over here, and they got married. I mean, sadly, the story doesn't end out tremendously romantically because he died very young. She was impoverished, and she brought up three sons in great poverty, and three very self-willed sons, one of them being my father. He was the youngest. And I think her life couldn't have been easy, but she plugged through. She brought the three boys up, and they all did well in their own lives. And for me, that's part of the romanticism and the enjoyment of simply writing this story about people who reach for an opportunity and who go for it and who rise above whatever bad cards they were dealt early.
It's very interesting to hear how, I suppose it was the turn of the former century when your grandparents were in turmoil in terms of early life starting. We're in that kind of turmoil at the moment, and so many young South Africans are finding that they too are going off looking for pastures greener. Of course, the story of one's life, you never really It never really ends. It continues through your antecedents, your kids afterwards. And so this story of your family is an absolutely beautifully written tome, but it's relevant to this part of the world. In fact, it's relevant to anyone that is South African and has lived through the changes that we've all experienced if you've been around for a couple of years. So there is a connection, reading it almost through the eyes of you were right at the stove face of many of the changes. So one reading this book can relate to the times, to the people, they're common to our experience. And in a sense, there is this instant connection to the genre. I found it absolutely fascinating, but particularly rooted here in the North Coast, I found your opening particularly poignant, and I just want to read it for a second. The foreword, which I found really, really... here it is. Yes, yeah. It talks about where you live right now and why we are chatting to you in this part of the world at this time. Where after a long absence, I now live again, you say, this time in an open-decked home some 40 kilometers north of Durban, surrounded by wild banana trees, looking out on an indigenous coastal forest where bushbuck graze in the morning and mongooses scurry across forest paths in the evening. The vervet monkeys periodically mount company-sized raids on banana trees, thundering across the roof to reach the foliage and teasing the dogs as they parade along the balustrades. At night, when the seas are high and the wind at the northeast, I can hear the crash of the waves on the beach. I walk through the coastal forest paths, and I'm on land my family once owned. I cycle on the laid-out roads of a developing township nearby, built on land my family once farmed, where the hotel-sized home of a billionaire stands. Once was the farmstead my grandfather and uncle built in the 30s, overlooking the ocean. And it goes on and on and on. This is your country. This is your land. This is your family history and heritage. Does it make you sad to see how things are changing and have changed from what they were?
You know, David, it's an important question, and I think one has to distinguish between change, which is good, and which I think you should welcome, and there are many, many things that are good on the North Coast. There are many excellent things for which we should all be very grateful. Change has brought that. We couldn't really have remained just a tiny cluster of little coastal hamlets. We had to change. That change is the one that I embrace. There is other change which is sad, and we all know that's sad, and, you know, sitting out on the barricades at Tiffany Bridge during the emergency recently, you begin to start thinking about how do things get this bad? And that's when you have the regrets. That's when you have the sadness. That's when you start saying, why? Why should it go wrong when everything was there for us? And how do we put it right? And that's the issue, I think, what you're saying. So for me, I don't really... I'm not depressed or morose about the fact we no longer farm. In fact, it's quite a nice thing not to be farming right now at the moment. I accept that as part of the process. I accept so many of the good things that this coast has given to me and to my family, and that this country has given to me and my family. Yeah. And I will never deny that, the great privilege and honors they gave us. But that maybe is even more so why, at this point, I start saying, why did this happen?
Yeah. Let's just quickly... take a run through the book, which is actually a run through your life. The early history is fascinating. It's all there to be unpacked and to be read. But the personal history, I think, is even more fascinating. You said that you were a particularly gifted scholar. You, in fact...
I think it was some of them an understatement. You know, I think my mom was trying to get me a job in the local handy hardware store, you know. So.
Well, I think that's encouraging to all of us that we're sort of not really academic achievers. You've certainly proven, I suppose, some of those early teachers hopelessly wrong if they ever said that you would not amount to much. But you emerged from school, obviously went into the army, and that was conscription back in the day. And from there you went to university. And what I found particularly interesting was that you really wanted to be a farmer initially, but then that wasn't a possibility you then thought, well, maybe diplomacy was your thing, and that was, but no, South Africa, apartheid, etc., etc. And if through a process of almost elimination, you settled on law, but with a particular bent towards political science, at a time when, wow, the country was almost about to, I suppose it was early days of a, relatively early days of the beginnings of change, but they were certainly there. And political science was, you were really at the stoke face of what was going to become probably the worst years of apartheid. And you found yourself at a fairly liberal university. But you had to pay your way. Your mum very kindly paid your tuition fees, etc. But the rest of it, you had to supply the wherewithal for, and you took some extraordinary jobs. Just unpack that for a sec.
Well, that's right. As I say, my mom did pay for it, and many thanks to her for that. But I, in order to live, to enjoy myself, I had to earn my own way and pay for my own lodgings and things like this. And so I did these any job that came along. And it was one of the first jobs that I got was on the railways, and that was as a fireman. Which is now a stoker on the locos operating out of Greyville Loco. I used to actually bank the fires as we took those steam engines up towards Cato Ridge and things like that. And it was incredible fun. And I can tell you, I got very, very fit very quickly. And I learned a lot of lessons, mainly about trying to sleep when you can and drink a lot of water. But it was great. I met a really interesting bunch of people I would never have met in sort of the, you know, in university or within my peer group. And when that closed, I then became a ticket examiner. And that was just working the suburban trains around Durban. And that was great fun. It was really, you know, Gartke's tickets, please, yeah. Gartke's tickets. But Friday night, of course, was like the guys were coming back from work and they were coming back to where they lived out in Ananda and places like that. Many of them had enjoyed a sup or two and they weren't going to have anybody asking them for a ticket. And funnily enough, it was accepted by the railways. You just keep yourself quietly out of way and pretend to do the job, you know. But that paid the bucks. And then the most exciting one really was taxi driver.
Do you know the music of Harry Chapin, the Cats in the Cradle guy?
Yeah.
He writes a couple of beautiful tunes about being a cabbie and stories around that. It's always been romantic for me. But yeah. Is it romantic?
It's a great life. It's a great life. And that's why I've got great sympathy for taxi drivers to this day. It was, I think, for me, the most enchanting thing about it was that you never knew who was going to open that door and get in your cab.
Yeah.
You could get the biggest, worst thug in the world, and I got a few of those guys. And then you got some real angels. You lived life very immediately. For me, of course, it was a perfect job as a student because you could go in and book out a taxi for 3 hours, drive it, give two-thirds of the money to the boss. The third you kept. So it was a perfect way of both earning a living for a student, but also, again, coming into contact with life, with the world. And at that time, 73, it was just at the closure of the Suez Canal because of the Yom Kippur War. And the roadsteads were full of ships, 70, 80 ships, full of sailors. And when they hit the shore, wow, they wanted to operate. And I was operating night shifts out of the ports. So I really got to see a real side of life that most people probably wouldn't see, wouldn't want to see in many cases.
And this is while you were becoming an educated, soon to become young journalist, and we're going to pick the story up shortly, but my very special guest, Brian Pottinger, former editor of the Sunday Times, former manager of major publications, and now sitting in the studio unpacking the story in a book called I Am Smiling, which I strongly recommend you get a hold of. But so we're going to take a musical interlude and we'll be back in just a flash. John Newman, Come and Get It. Well, there it is, 30 minutes to the top of the hour. You're on the Afternoon Show with Dave and Chantel and our very special guest, Brian Pottinger. He's the author of a book called I Am Smiling. We're promoting it at the moment because it's a good read and a fascinating story of a local lad made good. Incredibly good, in fact. Brian, you became an extraordinary force in the journalistic world. How did you get there? You graduated. You were offered an opportunity to become a sort of cadet journalist in Joburg, and then you joined the Daily News in Durban.
That's right. Yeah, Daily News was the newspaper that very kindly gave me my opening of why I have a special affection for the Daily News and the Natal Mercury. It was how do you get to the top? How do you become editor of the Sunday Times? Or do you just climb up that slippery slope? You know, there's no magic to it. I think hard work, a real passion and interest in the society and the people around you. That what drives you on.
And an ability to tell a story. I mean, you've always had that.
And the ability to tell a story. Yeah. I mean, that's been my one saving grace at school. I think I could tell a good yarn. My maths and science, that wasn't so hot, but that did, you know. And so, you know, you just put it together, my interest in politics. And then, I grew up a child of apartheid. I grew up in the apartheid era on the privileged side of the line. And it offended me greatly. And so when I could get into newspapers and start doing something about writing about the implausibility and the injustice of apartheid, I was very happy to do that. So essentially, it had all the elements together which made for a very fulfilling life for me.
And yet you're also rather critical of the extreme left. So you were kind of center left.
Yeah. I mean, in
voice of reason.
It all depends where you're sitting. You know, as far as the security police were concerned, I was, you know, kind of a
too far
demon in hell. You know, but for me, I was kind of sitting central.
Yeah.
I never had an inclination towards extreme leftist politics, and I had great difficulties with the revolutionary and violent agendas of the ANC. Those are things that I was able to discuss much later in my life with people, and I understand kind of some of the motivation behind it, but I couldn't put myself there. I just didn't want to be in that particular arena. And I grew up in a university where Rick Turner, Eddie Webster, these were my gurus, my mentors.
So you knew them, you worked with them, and they were victims of the hit squads?
The death squads, yeah. And that was after I left university when I was in journalism.
That must have had tremendous impact on your life.
Well, it wasn't a surprise. I'd rapidly come to the conclusion that by that stage, the apartheid state was holding itself together by a combination of attempting to seduce people to believe in the possibilities of reform, on the one hand, and then dread repression on the other. And death squads was part of that. Yeah. I got that particularly in the Eastern Cape. I worked there at the time of what was beginning to be the really upsurge of political movements. It was before the UDF even. It was groups of civic organizations and new trade union movements, unrecognized trade unions taking on the big multinationals. Very, very turbulent time. And there the security police were less than gentle. They made that particular colonel, I remember, who used to haul me in regularly for intimidations and sessions and interrogations. He said, things have been allowed to get away here. I'm here to clean them up. Yeah. And you're one of my problems right now. Oh. You know, so, you know, that sort of stuff.
So you came through that particularly rough school, if you like, of violent politics. Not necessarily from civic organizations being mm-hmm. violent. It was state sponsored violence, leaving a terrifying legacy, and obviously having to watch yourself right the way through. You became eventually the editor of the Sunday Times. I mean, that was a title. When you see how the Sunday Times has become almost a shadow of its former self, what are your thoughts about that?
I really don't want to introduce former colleagues. I have a great affection for the title, for its great traditions and histories, and I know many of the people who are there, and I respect their integrity and honesty.
Now I'm sounding like a politician. You've learned well.
Now I'm sounding like a politician. But I also have to say they're operating in a very tough environment because of so many competitive new media. When I was editor of the Sunday Times, we were selling over 500,000 copies a week. We were reaching 3.2 million people. That was a big market. Yeah. The Sunday Times now, I think, is battling at 220,000 or something.
Wow.
And that is a consequence of both the media change and the changing nature of media. It could also be a disaffection with the content of the newspaper. Many of the traditional readers of the newspapers were what we're going to call fairly conservative people. They may not agree with the political lines taken now. The Sunday Times done some good investigative and exposure work. But I have a more general concern about journalism generally, which wouldn't be related to the Sunday Times. I don't know if you want me to talk about that.
Time is always against us in these things. I would love you to come back and talk about that because it's a subject that's very close to, I think, all of our hearts.
Yeah.
just rushing through the book, you had an extraordinary career in journalism. Right at the top of the tree, you were bypassed for the most senior position, and there was definitely reading through the work, there was an idea that there was a race element that came into it at that stage. I think we've all been there. You however weren't embittered. You just left the trade and decided you were going off on a new venture. You went overseas to the UK and became the owner of a coffee shop. You and your wife set up this extraordinary story, and I'd love again to be able to unpack this thing. But the bottom line is, you have done, you've lived many lives in one, and you've packaged it all into a work that is extraordinary to read, easy to read. I actually read it in 2 days, and I'd sort of begun to despair that I would never read a book again because I haven't got time. A good book you can't put down. This is a good book.
Thank you.
We're not going to do the spoiler alert and go right through it, but I simply would like to suggest that you're listening to this right now. Have a read. Get a hold of a copy. Where is it available, Brian?
They're unfortunately not available through general bookstops, but they are available on Amazon and Kindle and in print versions, Smashwords in e-books and on Take a Lot in print version. So they can be bought online in any of those sources.
Talking about how industries have changed, there it is. You can buy the book online. It's called I Am Smiling, E.M. Smiling. I look at that title and I think, where does that come from? Well, you'll discover that hidden in the pages of this book are anecdotes about many former interesting people that we collectively in our experience have come across many times. My very special guest, Brian Pottinger, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you.
It's been great fun. Thank you very much.
Great book. I look forward to inviting you back in the studio and unpack that where to with journalism and the world that we live in. But right now, we're on with the show. One more tune before the news. Here is the Red Hot Chili Peppers, The Getaway.